I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Voting in Iran's presidential election is coming to a close, and while observers say it is the closest such election ever, many people there are regarding it as not very important. See, this is the fifth time since the revolution that Iranians have voted for a president, but many are asking themselves why they should bother. The Ayatollah remains the supreme leader, the clerics and jurists in Iran's Council of Guardians hold all the real power, and time after time, attempts by elected politicians to introduce reform have been squashed. So Iranian voters are right to be cynical. There's one candidate, a former police chief, who calls himself a fundamentalist reformist. But the credibility of Iranian politicians is important, and not just for the millions of people there who are looking for leadership, looking for the rule of law and for human rights. Many Iranians hope their country will become a nuclear power, and that makes their business everybody's business. So let's talk about what's next for Iran. Is this country ever going to move toward genuine reform? Is it possible that people will simply lose faith in the electoral process? And how does Europe and how does the rest of the world negotiate with a theocracy when it comes to key international issues like nuclear weapons? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're starting with Scott Peterson on the line from Tehran. He's a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor, and he is covering the election there. Scott, it's nice to have you back.
Thank you.
What have you seen today? Have you been able to, for example, measure the turnout in the election?
Well, there's actually been a surprising number of people who've been turning out. I mean, I think people were really expecting, after all the talk of boycott, and I've spoken to many, many Iranians, and you hear their voices all over the place saying, no, I'm not going to vote, etc. But I think on the day, we began to see in the course of this week, more and more people change their minds, decided a boycott was not going to be the way to go, that they really wanted to get their voice out there, even though in their minds, you know, really the choice is between bad and worse in terms of the candidates. So, just to give you an example of the type of turnout or large turnout that we've seen, I just came back from a polling station about an hour ago, and this was a polling station that had been given 1,000 ballots. This is in South Tehran, which is a fairly conservative area. They would have expected a fairly large turnout there anyway. So they were expecting about 1,000 ballots. Those ballots were gone by noon. They had to order more ballots, and by the time I left, which was just a couple of hours after that, they'd already been burned through another 500 or 600 of the next set of 1,000. So if that is the case in many other polling stations, then I think that turnout would have exceeded expectations. As it was, people were expecting 50%. But it seems that more and more people decided on the day to actually cast a ballot.
Now, I had a chance to see some of the campaigning in television images, and it looked surprisingly like a Western election, with songs blaring out of cars and nobody restricted to anything other than Western dress. That kind of moment in the campaign, Scott, is that likely to continue on after the election, or is that thought to be, you know, something which is allowed only for a short period of time in Iran?
Well, that is a very good question, and one that, of course, many Iranians are asking themselves, too. I mean, the kind of openness and kind of a falling away of social restrictions that we've seen literally just in the last few weeks here really has been unprecedented since the Islamic Revolution. I mean, it's only not even just been a few years ago, and really only a couple of years ago in some cases, where you just simply couldn't hear the kind of music, playing. It would have been illegal. This is, say, for example, Iranian music that's coming from Los Angeles, you know, from the exile community there. A lot of that music is banned here. And yet here at some of the campaign headquarters for Hashemi Rafsanjani, who is, of course, the front runner in this election, of former two-time president, I mean, he's basically, given carte blanche to his people anyway to do what they want. And in terms of the idea is to bring in as many young people as possible. And when you've got, 60 to 70% of the entire population below 30 years of age, you know, that is an incredible voting block. And all of the candidates have recognized the importance of bringing that youth vote along. And, what they recognize more than anything is that word of openness and that commitment to trying to be more and more free is what they want to hear. But how long that lasts beyond the election is really anybody's guess at the moment.
Scott, it won't come as any surprise to people listening to us to hear that politicians in Iran, like politicians here in America, make promises they can't keep. But if we go through all the promises of reform that we're hearing from even some of the more hardline candidates, it's hard to know what the people there make of all that. Have they given up on reform? Is there still some sort of deep bit of optimism in the Iranian voter that says, you know, yeah, maybe this person can deliver?
Well, it is interesting to see, not just to try and weigh the degree, you know, the levels of disillusionment, which are really very, very large, but also to ask and talk to young people especially, but talk to anybody who is still very much engaged in politics. And what you will find are people who still believe that change can take place within the system despite the difficulties, of course, that this reform president, Mohammad Khatami, has had during the last 8 years. And what people say is that, you know, I mean, there are so many different reasons and there's so many different rationalities for why things went wrong. I mean, some people say that the President Khatami simply wasn't strong enough to take on the conservatives, although he had the mandate to do it. They say that some of the candidates that are running now actually can, continue on with reforms and the reform agenda and actually do it in a way that will help bring along some of the conservatives. Others are recognizing, I think, that this entire, all the campaigns seem to indicate, I mean, are examples of how conservatives over time, and especially in the last year or two, have realized that they may risk their own political power if they don't give way on some of the social restrictions and some of the social adjustments. So we've really seen here in the last 6 months or last year and really kind of growing over that time and opening in terms of social restrictions. And it's the kind of thing that even under, you know, in the first year or two of Khatami's time, we just simply did not see. And I think that's a recognition from everybody that if that change isn't given a safety valve, then it can result in some very, very nasty politics indeed.
Scott, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Scott Peterson is a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. He is covering the election in Iran and joining us there live on the line from Tehran. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We are taking the measure of this country, the voter turnout, the voter expectations, and what they should expect from their politicians. And we'd like to hear from you on that, 1-800-423-TALK. Let me introduce the guests who will be with us for the balance of the hour. Dr. Mohammad Sahimi is joining us on the line from his home in California. He's a professor of chemical engineering at the University of Southern California. Dr. Sahimi, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
And Dilip Hero is joining us from a studio in Washington, D.C. He's a journalist, a historian, author of a number of books, among them Iranian Labyrinth. Dilip, it's good to have you with us as well.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm interested just in your reaction to what we're hearing from Scott, Dilip. There was so much expectation of voter apathy and a low turnout. Are you surprised to hear Scott saying that there are more people there than were expected?
Not at all. In fact, this is what I've been saying for the past week or so. You see, basically in the reformist camp, there was a debate. Some of them said that the system is beyond redemption and therefore we should boycott the election. And the other side said, no, we should participate, we can still change things, and so on. And it is the second school of thought which is now prevailing, partly because, see, opinion polls have shown, A, that no candidate will get 50% plus one vote. So Rafsanjani is not going to be just a straight shoe in.
There is going to be a runoff, yes.
They're bigger runoff. And secondly, that in the runoff, the chances of Mustafa Moin, who is a proper reformist, he belongs to the reformist party called Islamic Iran Participation Front, and that he is emerging as number two. And some people even go on to say that he might even be number one and have a contest with Rafsanjani. So I think all that goes to show that it's an open election, you know, we don't know. See, we don't know what the turnout will be, and in terms of turnout, you know, quick figures. The 97 election, 88% turnout, and 70% voted for Khatami. Next election, 66%, and 60% voted for Khatami. So it's an open game. We have to see how many people turn up, and I'm quite sure Mr. Rafsanjani will not get in the first run.
Mohamed Sahimi, do you think that the turnout in this election will in fact tell us more about the attitude of people in Iran than the person who may get the most number of votes?
Well, you have to remember that about 3 weeks ago, when the Guardian Council announced the names of the qualified candidates, at first they declared Mostafa Moin the main reformist candidate.
I'm not hearing him.
Do you hear me now?
Yes, I hear you loud and clear. Go ahead.
When 3 weeks ago, the Guardian Council declared Mostafa Moin the main reformist candidate as unqualified, there was a backlash among university students and also internationally. And therefore, they had to retreat and declare him qualified. But what happened was that...
Is this evidence to you that there is, in fact, some momentum behind reform despite everything that we hear?
Yes, there is momentum. And in fact, Moin has used a language that is almost unprecedented in Iran. He has talked about so many issues that no politician has dared to talk about, including bringing into the government the opposition that has been banned from participation, including the rights of women, including reaching an agreement with the West regarding Iran's nuclear program. So many issues that no politician had dared to talk about, and therefore that has created a sort of momentum. At the same time...
I'm going to stop you just there, Mohamed, if you don't mind. We have to take a short break, a chance for me to remind our listeners that we're at 1-800-423-8255. Taking a look at today's presidential in Iran, the turnout is going to be one measure of the level of or the appetite for reform among voters there. Also many other issues on the table, international issues such as Iran's interest in developing a nuclear program. We will be talking about all these issues as we continue. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. The Iranian election is drawing to a close as we speak, and this hour we're talking about the continued push for reform there, whether or not it has in fact lost its steam in using the voter turnout and also their choice of candidate as a way of measuring that. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to know how you're watching the events there unfold. Dilip Hero is with us from a studio in Washington, D.C. Mohamed Sahimi is with us from his home in California. Joining us now on the line from Tehran is Karim Sajapour. He is an analyst for the International Crisis Group, and he's been with us before. Karim, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Dick. It's good to be with you.
I'm interested in knowing what you saw today in Tehran. Scott Peterson said earlier that the turnout appeared to be higher than some people were expecting. What did you see?
Well, comparing it with 4 years ago, with the 2001 re-election of President Khatami, I was uneventful there. I think turnout was maybe higher than Western pundits anticipated. And I think what we have to ask ourselves is Tehran a microcosm of the rest of the country? I think Tehran turnout is going to be fairly low, maybe around 30%. But I think elsewhere throughout the country and the provinces, you're going to have a higher turnout.
And when you talk sorry, Karim, but when you are talking to the people there, what are they saying they are voting for?
First of all, I think anecdotally, about more than half of the people you talk to in Tehran claim they're not going to vote. Those who are going to vote, I think it's not a vote of conviction, as you saw 4 years ago with Mr. Khatami. There was a real sense that he was the right man for the job, and there was a sense that we can change this country via the ballot box. I think today it's a more, I would describe it as a two-man race between Mr. Moin, who is the leading reformist candidate, and Mr. Rafsanjani. And I think that people are not holding up great illusions about either candidate that they will be able to deliver on their grand talk of reform. I think those who are voting for Mr. Rafsanjani, it's a vote of expediency, thinking that, at the end of the day, he has a lot. We have a lot of concerns about him, but he's one of the few people, if not the only person in the country, who's worth carrying as much weight as the supreme leader. So after 8 years of having...
Karim, you're starting to break up here. I'm going to take this moment to say thank you for being with us. That's Karim Sajapour joining us there on the line from Tehran. He's an analyst with the International crisis group. And Dilip, if I can just come back to you on the kind of choice that people are making there. Karim and Mohammed are adding to the point that you made earlier, that there is this still sense among Iranian voters that they can say something to the clerical leadership by choosing reform-minded candidates. But, you know, I mean, if we look back, that's exactly what they did with President Khatami 8 years ago, 4 years ago. This tremendous push for reform, and the people have been disappointed at so many turns. I don't know really why they or what keeps them coming back.
No, I think, see, actually, the point really here is something very simple. And I speak from personal experience. I've been going to Iran since 79, and I made 12 visits. Now, the thing is, there's something on a piece of paper, which is the law, and then something in reality. Take a simple example. Unless you are married, men and women are not allowed to hold hands in public. And, of course, if you are sitting in a car, man and woman sitting next to each other, they have to prove that they are either closely related or married to each other. But you go to any park in Tehran, as I have done, after sunset, you find men and women holding hands, walking around, etc. Okay, now this one. Satellite dishes, 1995 law says no satellite dishes, you know, prison sentence, a lot of big fines, etc., etc. Now I can tell you my personal observation, and in my book I made a particular point to draw a map of Tehran, the East Wait Road, which is called Freedom Avenue. North of Tehran is affluent, westernized, outward-looking, and south of Tehran, which is two-thirds of Tehran, population-wise, is more Islamic, introverted, etc., etc. In the north of Tehran, at least one out of three homes have a satellite dish. And if somebody comes around, the police comes, somebody comes, and then you either give them some money or they say, okay, we are going to confiscate your thing, bring it to the police station, and you take to the police station some old junk lying around. They know it's old junk, and you carry on. So I'm just giving you an example that on one hand, you have this image of, you know, mullahs running everything. In real life, things have changed quite a lot, even though Khatami had huge problems. For example,
you're saying, though, that it's a little bit wrong to say that the man had no success as a reformer. He has moved the markers, right?
See, basically, he has changed the environment in which this election is taking place. So one has to understand the ambience in which this is taking place. Of course, we have to be skeptical. This may be just a passing phase. After a few weeks, the bad guys will come back. But no matter what happened to Khatami, you know, he has changed the discourse. And even conservatives, I mean, this guy, Kalibak, what is he calling himself? Fundamentalist reformist. I mean, see, the language itself is very important. Look, Khatami is 70 years old. Look at how he's projecting himself, surrounded by young people.
Okay, but the language, though, also has a certain sort of Orwellian quality to it. And part of the complaints that we hear from people there is that, yes, we can break the rules and we can do this, and we weren't allowed to do that before. But as you said, nobody's really sure when, you know, the next crackdown will come. Let me just ask you to hold for half a second, if I can, Dilip. We have a number of people who want to join us on the phone. So let's widen this out a little bit. 1-800-423-8255. Frankfort, Kentucky, and Salahi is joining us on the line. Hello, Salahi.
Hello. I had a question as to what the guests think as to what would be the next revolution for Iran, for the women of Iran.
Do you mean some kind of social revolution? Are you talking about something more violent?
Social revolution. They've been, I looked at the NPR site and also BBC site, and there's been a lot of protests, and there's been with women, young students, and young students are graduating in Iran much more higher rate than anywhere else in the world right now. And I'm hoping that the government in Iran will change without any help from the United States or Europe.
Mohammed Sahimi, your thoughts here on Salahi's question here, the room that this vast number of young Iranians have to try and make their voice heard. Can we talk about it in revolutionary terms?
Well, you have to remember that over 63% of all university students in Iran are women. And in fact, right now we have more educated women in Iran than men. And because of the discriminatory laws that have been passed after the Iranian revolution against women and their rights, there is a very strong feminist movement in Iran trying to change the laws within the system. And in fact, this movement has had some victories, and they have been able to change some of the laws, but they still need a lot more victories in order to be able to declare that the rights of men and women in the country are equal.
But is it going to change gradually, or is it going to change in one fell swoop? I mean, there were 80, 90 women who put their names for to be considered as presidential candidates, and the Council of Guardians said no to every single one of them. I'm just trying to look ahead to where the change comes from.
I think the changes will be gradual, the changes will be slow, but they will be coming. Even the most hardline elements of the society have recognized the need for change, the need for reform. It's a question of the pace, it's a question of who is going to do the change, who is going to be the leader of the change, and a question of that sort. So if we exclude the possibility of outside intervention, the change has to come from within the system, and it will come within the system. And in fact, that is the main argument that the reformists have been making to their disappointed supporters, that unless we try to make the change will come and will be enforced on us from outside. So it's better for us to participate in this process. It's better for us to push the system. And we've had some success, as Dilip pointed out. President Khatami has had some success. I don't agree with people who say that President Khatami didn't have any success. He changed the language of the society. He stopped some of the assassination and killings of dissidents and intellectuals. He stopped the arbitrary trials of many dissidents and intellectuals. And most importantly, what President Khatami did was making completely transparent the power structure within Iran, so that we know who are the decision makers, who make decisions as unelected members of the government, and how much elected part of the government, how much power the elected part of the government has. And all of these, of course, are useful for a reform movement that is trying to push the system to reform itself from within.
Let me just stop you there, if I can, Mohammed, and go back to Salahi, who's with us still from Frankfurt. Salahi, you are Iranian and living in America, is that right?
Yes.
You have family still in the country then?
Yes, I have my younger sister who still lives there.
And what's she telling you?
We haven't talked on the phone because they listen into the conversation, so we usually don't talk about politics on the phone.
And so when you listen to Dilip and Mohammed saying that, in fact, change is coming and change is likely to continue, albeit quite slowly, is that the way that you see the country as well?
No, I'm somewhat concerned with Bush having the military force in Iraq right now. If the Republicans have anything to do with it, I got a feeling there is going to be invasion in Iran or possible war with Iran anytime soon with the Bush rhetoric.
Dilapiro, it's perhaps an important part of what's happening both with the domestic and foreign policy in Iran. Not only that the Americans have 140,000 soldiers in a neighboring country, but that the main issue on the table is Iran's nuclear status. Yeah, either of these things features in this election? Are these matters that are being discussed?
Yeah, absolutely. I think let me just make a couple of points. Dick, again, I'm speaking personal experience. You know, women's role. Figures are in my book. Between 1976 and 1996, in 20 years, in Iran, women's literacy rate tripled. It was 28% in 76, 2 years before the revolution. In 96, 81% female literacy. One. Two, as we speak, in all of Iran, in all universities in Iran, women are 60%, 60%. In some faculties, their own universities, like humanities, women are 90% of the students. Now, I'm not suggesting every is a hunky-dory for women, but women have progress if you are looking at in these terms. So one other thing, I have been to Persepolis, I have been to the Shah's former palaces in Tehran, where you have official guides who are women, and those officially employed women do not wear the long coat, etc., etc. They have makeup, They show their hair and their official employees. Dilip, I'm telling you real facts.
Okay, but let me just step in here. We've got a caller on the line from Toronto, Canada, who I think may take issue with in part what we're saying about the way that women are moving ahead in Iran. Samin, is that accurate?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. When women cannot choose their own clothes, how can you say they are improving? Women cannot travel without the permission of their husband. How can they say they are moving ahead? When women cannot be a candidate for the presidency, how can you say they are moving ahead? When women cannot be study justice and be a judge, how can you say the woman moving ahead? Can you tell me that? Can you answer this?
My starting point was, not everything is hunky-dory. I gave you some figures, and you can check out these figures. 28% female literacy in 76, and in 96, 81%. Now, are you telling me that's going backwards? Of course.
Please.
Can I finish? I did not interfere when you were speaking. So allow me, give me the same privilege. Let me finish. Nobody is saying, not me, not anybody saying that women are exactly the equal, etc., etc. Not at all. I am saying that repeatedly. But I am looking at the iconic image of women, all of them clad in black chadors, moving around in the streets like ghosts. That's the typical image. Please look up the New York Times of yesterday. There is a picture there. These are women who are canvassing for these candidates, and they are wearing very skimpy, light material jacket, only going under their, just
below
their knees.
All right, let's Samin back in here. Samin, let's hear from you. Go ahead.
Okay. First of all, these are my rights. Nobody can. These people take it away from me. If I have choose some kind of color, that's my decision. Nobody can make it for me. Okay. And second of all, these are, you think in 21st century, these are the important issue that we have to talk about. The women, this government shows that they are not willing to listen to the people, first of all. Second of all, you're saying Khatami is different. Rafsanjani already had 2-3 times to be a prime minister. What he did, close the university, 8 years war with Iraq, nonsense.
Samin, let me just step in here. Are you saying that there has been no change worth measuring, that when we talk about alterations in dress and alterations in literacy, that these don't matter?
These are basic change. These are the house is full of mold and mildew and is falling apart, and you are painting the wall. That's what I mean.
Can I say a few words here?
Go ahead, Mohammed.
Pardon me?
Well, here is the issue. I agree with Simin that the issue of clothes and makeup and so on are personal issues, and nobody should interfere in them. However, over the past 6 weeks, I traveled with Dr. Shirin Ebadi, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2003 as her translator around the United States. And she always points out to some progress that Iranian women have made over the past 25 years. After the Iranian Revolution, there were many discriminatory laws passed against women. But the feminist movement has made a lot of progress. It would be unfair to say that they haven't made any progress. And I point out to a few of them. As Dilip said, the fact that over 63% of Iranian college students are women is a big progress. The fact that we have a vice president in Iran for environmental affairs is a big progress. The fact that the custody law, which was totally unfair and passed right after the revolution, has been changed and has been modernized in the sense that it gives automatic custody of children to the mother up to the age of 7. And after the age of 7, the court decides whether they should go to their father or mother, is a big progress. So progress has come, progress has been slow, but it would be unfair and it would be totally unrealistic to say that there hasn't been any progress. And by the way,
let me just put a last question to Samin, if I possibly can. Samin, it's Dick here in the studio. Quickly, because we're coming to a break. Do you think this election is going to make any difference at all?
No, does not make anything at all, because first of all, the base law in the country is not changing. I don't know what to call it in English, but in Farsi said qanun asasi. It doesn't change. If any candidate come to the power is following that rule, the cleric, the top cleric are the one who making last decision. The people decision is not important in that country. It's the time that regime must go.
Samin, I need to stop you there. We have to take a short break. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join the conversation as we talk this hour about the progress of reform in Iran. Does the presidential election that is just wrapping up in that country today, is it likely to make a difference? And how should the rest of the world expect to deal with the new Iranian leadership? 1-800-423-TALK. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection on this day as Iranians are at the polls choosing their next president for the next 4 years, a chance for us to talk about what that means, not only in terms of reform, but in terms of international relations and the nuclear issue, which is pretty important not only to Iranians, but to people in Europe and in this country as well. Mohammad Sahimi, you wrote about this in the piece that I read of yours in The Wall Street Journal recently, and I'm a little bit confused. The nuclear issue, it seems to me, stoked up nationalist feelings right across the country. Everybody in Iran seemed to be saying, we don't want Europeans and we certainly don't want Americans telling us what to do with our nuclear fuel and what we can do in terms of nuclear policy. How's it all going to change with a new president?
I don't believe the fundamental policy that Iran has regarding its nuclear issue will change unless a hardliner wins in Iran, and in order to make a deal or a bargain or an agreement with the West, they might agree to curtail in Iran's nuclear program in return for not having any protests against violation of human rights in Iran and that type of thing. Otherwise, I don't believe Iran will change its policy. I believe Iran is firm in pursuing development of nuclear technology. I don't know whether they are trying to make a bomb, but what is certain to me is that they will never agree to scrap completely and eliminate completely the uranium enrichment program that they have.
Let me just take, for example, Rafsanjani, who is the front runner. Is he the sort of politician who might, in fact, trade away the option of a nuclear weapons program for the right to have a curtain drawn around the country so, you know, issues of human rights and issues of reform are not raised and complained about in European capitals and here in Washington?
That's right. You see, if you look at the platform of Rafsanjani, he never talks about human rights. He never talks about democracy. He never talks about any of these issues. What he talks about is economic reform at home and reaching an accommodation with the United States and Western Europe outside the country. So he is the type of politician who can make that type of deal. He belongs to the clerics. I don't believe he cares much about political development, advancement towards democracy and respect for human rights. But he is a pragmatist. He wants to develop the country if he can. And in order to be able to do that and in order to have a free hand inside Iran and not having constant criticism from outside, he will try to reach an accommodation with Western Europe and the United States regarding Iran's nuclear program.
1-800-423-8255 to join this conversation. To Cape Cod, Massachusetts, Mark is with us. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Are you thinking also about this nuclear issue?
Well, actually, I do, and I have a question. I am U.S. citizen. I've been in USA for 35 years, and I consider USA my country, and I defend it against any other foreign force. Although I have my country of origin is Iran, and from my accent, you know, it's very similar to your guest host or any other Iranian that is online.
So what are you thinking about the nukes?
What the question I always have in my mind is what gives the right to any country such as USA or any other European countries to decide and determine who is qualified to have nuclear weapon. While USA or European countries, they have perhaps the largest stockpile of nuclear weapon, chemical weapon, biological weapon, or any other weapon that is not really known even to mankind. In fact, USA, the country that I am citizen of and I am willing to defend, right now has a program which they are trying or are striving to make nuclear weapon usable. Right. And this is a question that I always had, and I don't understand why is it that a bunch of countries who have such a tremendous stockpile of nuclear weapon deciding
get to choose who does and who doesn't. DiLapiero, if you and I went for a walk down Freedom Street, I'm sure we would hear almost exactly the same sentiment from the people in Tehran.
Yeah, I think it's basically, as you know, I think there was a very good report done by the Neil McFarquhar in the New York Times 2.5 weeks ago. He talked to Iranians for about 2 weeks, and his conclusion, with which I agree, is that no matter what the politics of the person he talked to is, or they're young or old, middle class or working class, they all say that Iran has the right to develop nuclear technology according to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Now, in that treaty, as you know, Dick, there are two operative articles. Article 4 applies to non-nuclear weapons countries which agree not to develop weapons in return for getting all the civilian technology from the other 183 or 184 non-nuclear weapons countries. And Article 6 is the one which nobody talks about. Article 6 requires the declared nuclear weapons countries, of which there were five in 1970, excluding Israel, that they will start disarming and take out these nuclear weapons out of the arsenal. And that has not happened. That even what happened, the review conference in 2000, the USA has not done it, etc., etc. So what it simply means, Iranians are saying, if we have the NPT, we have certain rights, we have certain obligations. Our obligation is not to develop weapons, but our rights of getting civilian technology have been circumscribed and limited because of the economic sanctions the Americans and Europeans have imposed on us. So that is the key point, you know. And
all right,
so let me,
if I can, just take that a step further with Mohammed. This question of sanctions is a key one, because when you hear reports from Iran, particularly detailing the lives and the futures of these millions of young Iranians trying to figure out what their prospects are, the economy of that country is not in good shape. So when America and Europe tighten the economic screws, you know that it is being felt in that country. Does that mean that Europe and the U.S. will in fact be able to persuade the new Iranian leadership, whoever that is, that in fact by lifting economic sanctions, they can curtail a nuclear program? Is that the kind of deal that might be struck?
That is what Iran has been talking about. They have been talking about limiting the uranium enrichment program to a few thousand centrifuges at Natanz facility in return for very significant concession, economic concession, on the part of the United States and Western Europe, including lifting the American sanctions against Iran. So that is the type of deal that, for example, Rafsanjani may be able to pull off if he's elected as president, and some people in fact believe that the nuclear program in Iran is being used by the Iranian leaders as a sort of exacting great economic concession, and in particular lifting American economic sanction against Iran.
Let me, if I can, Mohammed, take this another step further with one of our callers. Sarush is joining us now on the line from Nashville in Tennessee. Sarush, what do you think?
Good morning, Dick. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think what I was just mentioning to the lady I was speaking with, that this incentive program that EU and US are talking about of the carrot and the stick, this is just an entirely a mistake, because there is an old saying, I'm sure you heard about the scorpion and the frog, that scorpion told the frog, I will not sting you, get me across the river. Once they got in the middle of this river, scorpion st- done. The frog, and frog said, why did you do that? Now we're both going to die. He said, well, I can't help it. It's in my nature. This is what these guys are. These guys have no morals as far as when it comes to the rest of the world.
Are you talking about the elected politicians in Iran? Or are you simply talking about the clerical leaders there?
I'm talking about the hierarchy, the leaders. And that constitution will never be a democratic constitution as long as there's a supreme leader. And with this nuclear program, now this is something that these guys are using for more publicity and such. Unfortunately, it's true.
Okay, but I'm going to put you in the State Department Advice Bureau here and say, right, okay, so are you saying that you should have absolutely nothing to do with these people because you disagree with their policies? If Iran is in fact going ahead to develop its own nuclear weapons, I would bet you'd find most diplomats saying, doesn't really matter, you know, who they are and what they think. It's better to engage with them than to turn a blind eye to what's going on there.
I think that is true. I think you have a good point there. I do agree with that, that you cannot just ignore them, because with ignoring them, they're just going to get worse.
And Dilip, if there is a reformer or someone with some reform issues on the agenda who is elected president, does it mean that anything changes in the way that the EU and the U.S. then engage with Iran, or does this nuclear question and the issue really operate on an almost different level from the politicians, the elected politicians?
Yes, Dick, as you know, I am based in London, and I can tell you that the European leaders are praying that Rafsanjani gets elected, because they say they are looking for what they call pragmatic leadership, you know, and that he will, if he strikes the deal with them, and that he will be then able to sell this deal to the supreme leader.
Even if this is not the best thing for Iranians. I mean, people once said that Saddam Hussein was a pragmatic leader. At least you could do business with him. You know?
I'm sorry. Saddam Hussein, totally different ballgame. You see, again here, if we're talking psychology, because earlier a caller talked about psychology and scorpion and so on. You see, quite simply, it doesn't matter. I mean, don't ask me whether I know they're going to make it, the intention to make it or not make it. That is, nobody can prove it one way or the other. All we have to say, as we speak now, the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, has said we do not have a positive evidence that they are actually engaged in making a weapon. We stop there. Now, in terms of talks that are going on between the Iranians and the European Troika, which is Britain, France, and Germany, it is important from psychological viewpoint or the bazaar viewpoint. As you know, chapter one of my book is about the bazaar, where you haggle, which means that they have to maintain ambiguity, whether they are making it or not making. Suppose we have definite evidence they are not making it, then who would want to talk to them, and who would want to say, if you do this, then we'll give you that, and so on. So you need a card in your hand to play if you have no card, and that psychologically is what they are happening. Secondly, I know the details of what's going on with the Europeans. Basically, Iranians are saying, don't tell us that we are floating on oil lake, etc., etc. Why do we want this? They say, ask this question of the Russians. Russians have a huge amount of oil. Russia has the largest natural gas reserve in the world, but Russia has a huge power plant, a nuclear power plant industry. Not only that, they export it to India, to China, also to Iran. They are making this one plant. So don't tell us because we have oil, Russians have oil.
Don't treat us like second class.
No. They are saying, because nobody ever puts that question to Mr. Putin. Why are you having nuclear power plants? Why are you exporting them all over the world? You see, now, point is that the Iranians are looking ahead. Their energy demand is rising very fast, and so they are saying oil is not forever, so we want nuclear power plants. What's going on now, I can tell you, that they are negotiating with the Europeans that you agree to equip 10 nuclear power plants for us over the past several years or 10 years, whatever, and in return, then we can talk about something.
All right, let me stop you here. I just want to make sure that we're getting to a number of the points that our callers want to raise. So we're going next to Franklin, Vermont, and Bill is joining us on the line. Bill, thanks for calling.
Sure. I have a sort of observation to make, which may or may not be accurate. You have the Taliban in Afghanistan, the Sunnis in Iraq, and the clerics, which seem to maintain an inordinate amount of power in Iran. My question is, do you anticipate that in the future there will be some lessening of that power devolving to the more political or secular figures and therefore back to the public to allow some of the freedoms that they are seeking? And I'll take my response off the air.
Okay, Bill, and I'm going to simplify it if I can and basically take Iraq and Afghanistan out of the equation, because I really like the basic thrust of your question. Mohammed, I'm going to put you to work on this. How does the Council of Guardians, how does the Ayatollah allow power to go to the elected politicians and still retain the kind of control that they want? It seems like it's an equation that's never going to add up.
Well, Dr. Moeen, who is the main candidate of the reformists, has promised that if he is elected president, he will first try through legislation to curb the power of Guardian Council regarding many issues that they hold the veto over.
Okay, but just let me interrupt you on that one. I thought the Guardian Council had the right to overrule legislation that came from the elected parliamentarians.
Yes, and then if that doesn't work, the Iranian constitution, the present Iranian constitution, does allow a referendum on important issues facing the country. And Dr. Moeen has promised that if he cannot push reforming the power of the Guardian Council, he will put that to a referendum. Whether he will succeed or not remains to be seen. We don't even know whether he will be elected or president or not. And in fact, that is one of the main criticisms that President Khatami had, that why he never tried to put the issue to a referendum. He did submit a legislation to the parliament carrying the power of Guardian Council. It was approved by the sixth session of Iranian parliament, but the Guardian Council vetoed it. So the next step would have been to put it to a referendum, but President Khatami was not willing to do it. But Dr. Moeen has promised that if he's elected, he will try to do that. So there are mechanisms, at least in theory, there are mechanisms for changing and limiting the unlimited power of Guardian Council, which is in fact right now the main obstacle to democracy in Iran. The Guardian Council and what it has done and controlled by extreme right and extreme hardliners are the main obstacle to democracy in Iran.
Dilip, simple question. How do you take power away from them and put it in the hands of people who are elected?
Yeah, that's true. I think, you see, I think we have to really start with the basics. The basics are the name of the country. It's called Islamic Republic of Iran. So, you know, it's within Islam and, of course, the republic. So it's really power belongs to the public. That's one thing. Secondly, it's totally wrong to say unelected supreme leader. The supreme leader in Iran is elected in the same way as the U.S. president is elected, through an electoral college. An electoral college in Iran is called Assembly of Experts. There are 83 of them. They are directly elected. They have 8-year life. Let me just say, as soon as Khomeini died in June 89, Assembly of Experts met and Khamenei's name was put forward. He only got 6-0 votes out of 83, and 12 voted against him. The rest abstained. And every Assembly of Experts, when they have a new one, 8 years, they have to renew.
Okay, but it's more like the choice of a pope than it is like the choice of a president. The people don't really have a say in that process, do they?
No, no. Yeah, but you see, again, I'm sorry. I think you have to say, you might say the same thing about George W. Bush. Why did he get in November 2000? He had less popular vote than Al Gore. How did he get in?
I'm going to stop you on that. I don't have any more time. I'm sorry. We have just a few seconds left in the program, which gives me only the opportunity to thank Dilip Hero, who is author of Iranian Labyrinth, and Mohammed Sahimi, who is professor of chemical engineering at the University of Southern California. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.